touched by the Nazi in a very
Yeah.
intimate way. And she has, and in order for, and she's a strumpet. And she's been redeeming herself by being on the side of England and leading this army like Joan of Arc did, you know. But she still, so she is redeemed. And Holmes says over her corpse, he says, she will be honored, but she can't live because, you
No.
know, she's, in order for her to be redeemed, she has to die. It's a, you know, it's 1942.
It's a strange morality that has nothing to do with the real world and only to do with the censoriousness of Hollywood at the time.
There's an east wind coming, Watson.
No, I don't think so. Looks like another warm day.
How a movie ends designates what kind of movie it is, in spite of the other sort of tropes it seems to take on. And
Yeah.
so this movie goes from the girl who sacrificed herself to avenge her husband's death to actually reading this piece from Conan Doyle's last Sherlock Holmes story. Now, Conan Doyle got his knighthood not for creating Sherlock Holmes, but for writing popular propaganda pieces. This is from 1927. And so, certainly, the aftermath feelings from the First World War. I believe he lost a son during the
Yeah.
First World War. And so, it's used to, you know, get us on board. You know, this is what the fight is about.
Good old Watson. The one fixed point in a changing age. There's an east wind coming all the same. Such a wind has never blew on England yet. It will be cold and bitter, Watson. And a good many of us may wither before its blast. But it's God's own wind nonetheless. And a greener, better, stronger land will lie in the sunshine when the storm is cleared.
And then at the end, it's the war bonds to support the film. So this is like a pure war effort film, right from like the darkest years of the war. 1942, we were engaged at the Battle of Guadalcanal in the Solomons, which is considered a turning point, but this was just starting. And then in the real war, or the real main part of the war, Stalingrad, the siege of Stalingrad was going on at this in September of 1942. So things were
And that's
still,
the east wind, right?
yeah.
The east wind is coming from Soviet Union.
The
That's implied in
commies.
there too, yeah.
Well, we've been talking about a light comic serious thriller masterpiece, Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror. And we've been here with Lisa Neville, always welcome, and Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time, his monthly short story reading enterprise. And we'll be back sometime later this year with yet another very special edition of Film at 11.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross from KGUA FM, Walla, California. When I'm in Portland, which is often, I listen to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to Pathways, a show featuring conversations with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. You can find out more about the show or listen to the program archive at kboo.fm/Pathways.
I love you, KBOO.
Goodbye.
morning and welcome to that vegan show on 90.7 FM KBOO in Portland. Today we have two guests from the Northwest Animal Rights Network, also known as NARN. NARN advocates for the rights of all sentient beings and the right to choose to be free from oppression and exploitation. They pursue campaigns and facilitate education, and they connect Pacific Northwest organizations together. Today we have Hannah Thompson Garner, NARN's Director of Advocacy and Mission Advancement, who previously served on NARN's Board of Directors. While working toward her law degree, Hannah studied wildlife trafficking around the world, and prior to working with NARN, she also worked for or volunteered at a number of other animal-related nonprofits. Rachel Bjork is the current board president, active with NARN since 2000. She's a longtime animal advocate, and she strongly identifies with NARN's mission of networking with other organizations. She has a particular personal focus on ending animal vivisection. Thank you, Hannah and Rachel, for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
So tell us how NARN got started.
NARN, according to the stories I have heard, NARN got started in the late 1980s by a group of local animal advocates in Seattle, and they saw what a lot of other groups in the area were doing, and they wanted to find a way to bring the organizations together so that all those groups with similar interests could work together. And they felt like it would be, you know, stronger and more effective if they could work together. So it's really been strong in networking from the very beginning.
Yeah, and it's something that we've continued today too.
Yes. That makes a lot of sense, stronger together. So tell us more about the mission of NARN.
The mission has generally remained constant in that we strongly believe in, as we've mentioned, networking with other organizations, and that it's been done through a variety of means. And, you know, our mission to end the exploitation and abuse of animals through demonstrations, through educational campaigns. It's really what has changed over the years that I have been involved in the kinds of events that we do in terms of, you know, we've gone from in person to doing more remote stuff. But doing educational work has always remained a standout, and we do try to do creative campaigns and also be very strategic in the campaigns that we choose. We don't really want to just protest to protest. We want to have like, well, what are we asking folks to do? And we want to have a ask because we don't want to, you know, basically waste people's time, and we don't want to yell at people unless there's a very specific reason why we chose that tactic. And so we do put a lot of thought into the work that we do, and we believe in having a strong community. It's tough to be somebody that strongly cares about all animals, all sentient beings in this world, and so having a strong community is really important. I know that was something that kept me part of NARN in the beginning, was just feeling like I had found my community. And it's I think that NARN is an important organization, which is why I stayed involved so long.
Yeah, you have been involved for a long time, and that community support is really important, especially when you're, you know, working on something that's can be very disheartening, to say the least, at times.
Yes. And one of the founders of with NARN had also done work with social work, for lack of a better word, and like with street kids and things like that. So we've also had compassion for the human animals, which can be challenging when human animals do pretty horrible things. But, you know, we try to see the good in everybody as much as possible.
Right. That's great. I think that's something like vegans get accused of, like, that we don't like humans, but we do like humans too. It's just hard sometimes when we see what some of them are doing.
Oh yeah.
Yes. I think what I try to remember anyway is that people can make really horrible choices and do horrible things. It doesn't necessarily mean they're horrible people. And it's hard to remember that sometimes, but I think it's necessary in order for us to have a, not just be depressed all the time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And Narn also really tries to work with other movements outside the animal rights movement. And so we are working with people. We are pretty involved in the reproductive justice movement right now in Puget Sound, which is, you know, people focused. We have been invited to talk about non-human animals in the reproductive justice space through our work with them. It's been a pleasure working with people and talking about the similarities actually of our movements. So it gives me hope, and it's one of my favorite things about working at NARN, actually, is getting to network with different people.
I love that as well. And you know, there's the saying that all oppression is connected, and I really do feel that is true. And you know, the people that work in slaughterhouses, that's a horrible job. I always like to say, like, nobody grows up wanting to work in a slaughterhouse. And it's a really exploitive industry, and the people that live near factory farms and CAFOs, it's, you know, it's terrible. And a lot of communities are exploited by the animal agriculture industry. And really, we're just othering the animals in the same way that we other quite a few human animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And people don't always know that there could be another way. So they just, you know, think they have to accept these conditions they're in. So not that it's easy to break out of them sometimes. But.
Yes. Unfortunately, for many people, they don't have the option to like move.
Right.
Or that job in the slaughterhouse is the only job that they can get, you know, if they're an undocumented worker or underage.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, I have the same experience with doing this radio show, is, you know, just coming across so many people who are out there trying to help animals and people and, you know, the environment. So it's really nice to know that there's all these people out there doing things from the ground up. So let's talk about some of your initiatives and activities that you have going on. So one of the things we wanted to touch on was the animals in labs. Can you tell us about how that's going?
Yeah, I can speak to that. It's my thing I know most about. You know, the animals in labs campaigns, they do take a long time. It is a pretty difficult in terms of, you know, when we talk about like veganism, then the individual can opt out, right? We can choose not to buy or consume animal products in the same way that we can choose not to buy cosmetics, but you can't really opt out of animal testing because it's just so pervasive. So we understand that it may take a while to shut down the primate center, but we still want to work on that. It is, we feel, a feasible goal. They are one of 7 regional primate research centers. They will have to reapply for a grant from the NIH in a few years. And the thing is, a lot of people just aren't aware that the University of Washington houses hundreds of primates, primarily underground on the University of Washington campus.
Wow.
They don't know that there is a primate breeding facility in Arizona. And it's a facility that's on tribal land, actually. They don't know that a lot of those monkeys down there are exposed to the this disease called valley fever, which is actually being, you know, spreading to more places around the U.S. In fact, there was an article in the Washington Post that discussed how debilitating valley fever is to human animals, and various people have caught it, and it's just wrecked their lives. But the University of Washington has these animals, and the macaques primarily, they're well aware that they get exposed to valley fever. They've had several of the primates die, and they still ship them around the United States. And people don't know this. And so we focus a lot of our energy on educating people through a variety of means, whether that's protests, like we have this one coming up on Saturday, the University of Washington has their Apple Cup game, which is very popular. So we'll be down by the stadium. And then we have another, we have like a graphic novel that we are putting together, and it's telling the story of what happens to the macaques at the UW through one particular macaque that was named Ricky Bobby. It was named Ricky Bobby by the researchers. We feel that if we can focus on an individual that really is representative of a lot of the animals there, that that's a good way to tell a story. And you know, people don't really understand that the kinds of research. They think, some people anyway, that like it's groundbreaking research, but it's not really. It's very basic research. It's just to publish a paper. It's really quite horrible just how sloppy the science is. They don't really learn much of anything from it, and it costs a lot of money. And so it's taxpayer dollars going to pay for this. And to me, it's just, it's not only sad, it's horrible for the animals, obviously, that are trapped there, but we could be doing so many other things and actually helping human animals if we stopped spending so much time and money and lives on doing horrible things to, you know, non-human animals. We're not really learning much of anything. And so, yeah, that is, I could talk at length about animal testing and how horrible it is, but yeah, that is, by focusing on the Primate Research Center, we feel that that is a reasonable, feasible goal, and that the UW has got to at some point realize that they are on the wrong side of history. They can, that university has done a lot of positive things, and they have quite a few other methods to do research. They have like at least one organ on a chip. So they could absolutely move away from doing terrible things to macaques.
Yeah, it just seems like once something is going, like, you can't stop it. Like, we can't. I mean, I know it's a lot more complicated than that, but there's somebody's, you know, getting a lot of money somewhere for that.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know what it is, but it just seems like it's so hard to stop.
It is very hard to stop, and I think that there's a couple reasons for that. One is you have these individuals that have invested a lot of their career into doing these things, and for them to say, like, oh, with this thing I've been doing for 10, 20 years, or even 5 years for that matter, they've invested so much of their...
Right, so there was a little glitch, if you could repeat what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I
think there's a couple reasons why animal research continues, and it's so pervasive, and it's so hard, especially for some institutions to get out of. And one is that the people that are heavily involved in it are very invested in terms of that they have convinced themselves that what they are doing is helpful and it's right. And it's going to help humans someday. And if they admit that what they've been doing is wrong, that's pretty hard for someone to say, like, wow, I've just done all of these terrible things to animals. I've wasted all of this time, and what I did is not good. You know, it's wrong. It's just bad science. And I think it's very, very difficult for people to come to terms with that. A lot of us don't want to say, like, what I did was wrong. And then the people that have gotten to that level, you've also funneled out all the people that have questioned it, because you have plenty of people that are interested in neuroscience or various kinds of biology, or, you know, you name it, these various fields of science. They go down this path and somebody says, well, we want you to do an experiment on a mouse, or we want you, and then they'll, you know, basically, that's kind of where it starts, is the mice. Right. And that generally involves killing the mouse, because there's a humane endpoint. And so the people that don't want to do that leave the program, and the people that become okay with that, those are the ones that stay. And so it's this self-selecting group of people that have either don't particularly care about the animals, who have learned to compartmentalize these feelings and just shut that off and stuff it down into a hole they never look at. So I think those are two of the primary reasons why it's really hard for institutions to move away from animal research.
Yeah, thank you for explaining it that way. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but because I also don't know that much, but like I'm from St. Louis, so I know WashU used to do the vivisection. I'm not sure if they're still doing it or if you know anything about that. And then I live very close now to OHSU. And I didn't even know like that they had primates there till not too long ago. I heard about it.
Yes. They also have one of the regional primate research centers, and they also do terrible things there. I don't think very many academic institutions have moved away from animal research. Unfortunately, the ones that have been doing it probably still are. They may not necessarily work on primates because primates are even more expensive to take care of, and they have to buy them from somebody. And I mean, the University of Washington charges quite a bit of money for their animals from the Arizona breeding facility. You know, ironically, I think it's easier for companies like pharmaceuticals to move away from doing animal research methods because they're not invested. They just say like, well, the FDA says we have to do this, so we're going to. If they can do it, find a cheaper way to get their drugs in the market, they will. They don't really care one way or the other.
Well, I appreciate you explaining it to us and the work that you're doing to try to get it to end.
Well, I hope we can be successful.
Okay. Let's go ahead and talk about the Captivity is Cruelty initiatives.
Hannah, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. I can take that. So our Captivity is Cruelty is targeting the Seattle Aquarium. And the reason why this caught our interest is because right now, as we speak, the aquarium is actually building a tropical shark tank on the waterfront of Seattle. And I say tropical because it is literally tropical. It's going to feature non-human animals from the Coral Triangle, which is in the Indonesia region. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily make sense for a Pacific Northwest aquarium that says that they are educational about the Pacific Northwest, for one thing.
Right.
But, you know, what we're doing is we're trying to spread awareness of how cruel holding animals in captivity is. It's exceptionally cruel for many, many marine creatures. It's because we don't really know the effects of captivity with a lot of non-human marine animals. And so not only do we not know the effects of captivity on them, we keep confining them. So this shark tank is particularly upsetting because, you know, they're bringing in more sharks, more rays, more tropical fish from a region that is nowhere near us. We're coming at this campaign kind of through three legs. We're, of course, focusing on the animal welfare component of it all, the captivity is cruelty part. And we have really been looking at the effects of captivity on sharks, which is not really known. And there's not a lot of information there. Sharks are long, you know, they have a very long range. They swim a lot of miles. And of course, that's not conducive to tank life. And so, you know, that's a good example. We don't really know the effects of confining a shark who travels many, many miles in the wild. We don't know what that does to their psyche or to their body. And so that's one aspect of it. And we're also looking at the wild capture of giant Pacific Northwest or giant Pacific octopus. What they do with the giant Pacific octopus has been going on for quite some time. It's nothing new. It's not related to the new shark tank. But what they do is they go and capture a wild giant Pacific octopus out in the Puget Sound, and they haul them back to the aquarium and they put them in a rather small tank for viewing. They hold the octopus, you know, for some time up until the octopus is dying and ready to reproduce, because octopus, you know, they reproduce and then they end their life cycle. So the octopus are really only released when they're about to die. So, you know, if you can imagine that, getting yanked out of your wild home, thrown in a tank, and then returned only when, you know, you're meant to reproduce and die, it's quite sad. And so we're trying to spread awareness of this practice as well as the shark tank. So that's the animal welfare component. We also have a climate change component, because the shark tank is expected to generate a huge amount of emissions. Yeah, what it's going to do is it's going to take in water from the Puget Sound, filter it all out, cool it down or heat it up, you know, to get it to be a tropical fish temperature instead of a Puget Sound temperature. And that's going to take a lot of energy. And then they are going to, you know, once it cycles in the tank, they're going to put it back out in the Puget Sound. So they have to refilter it again and redo the temperature. So a huge amount of emissions is going into this tank. And then the third leg is actually a tax equity issue. A just astronomical amount of public tax dollars has gone to this shark tank. Most recently, about $20 million. That's, you know, just one allocation of funds that's been given to it. That's public funds. So what happened was this $20 million, it was taken from something called the REIT tax, which is a real estate tax. This tax is earmarked for public infrastructure projects, like serious public infrastructure projects, like developing affordable housing, fixing bridges, fixing crumbling infrastructure, which Seattle is known for. We just had one of our main bridges have a hole in the middle of it, and it was only recently fixed. And so they're taking money out of this important REIT tax, taking it away from projects where people could really, really benefit from it, and giving it to a tropical shark tank, all under the guise of boosting tourism. The Seattle Aquarium says that this project is justified because it's a conservation project. They will be breeding endangered leopard sharks who are native to Indonesia. And supposedly they will be, I believe, breeding them, and then once they are still eggs, shipping them back to Indonesia to grow in a nursery that they have there. You know, they have these complicated partnerships, so they're relatively, you know, pretty invested in this shark tank. But what we've been trying to do is get them to pivot to a virtual shark tank instead, which is actually pretty cutting edge. Other aquariums have started experimenting with this. It's very cool. You can get up close and personal with, you know, a shark. It's virtual, but you can definitely get closer and have more of an interaction with it than you could watching a sad live shark just swim in circles around this tank. So we've been urging that a pivot to virtual reality, which is also in line with Seattle and its tech city persona.
True. I know sometimes I'm naive and I just live in my own little bubble, but it's just like, didn't we already go through this, like with the Seaspiracy and like the other aquatic parks? Like, it just feels like a big repeat. Mm-hmm. And then to hear that they're taking money from housing and infrastructure to do this is just, my mind kind of wants to explode a little bit right now.
Yeah, it's infuriating. It really is.
So yeah, that's very complicated. But it sounds like you have a handle on going at the different reasons why it shouldn't be happening. Mm-hmm. So, is there an event associated with that?
Yeah, so we have been holding periodic demos outside of the Seattle Aquarium. We have a blow-up shark and a tiny shark tank that we put the shark in for dramatic effect. We do pretty well at these demonstrations. We've actually gotten people to turn around as they're going into the aquarium, you know, reconsidering why they're going and visiting. Yeah, we don't have a demo scheduled Right, Rachel, we don't have a demo.
Right. We are waiting. Yeah. We wanted to coincide with an aquarium event. We were able to have one right near Halloween because the aquarium had events to encourage people to come and dress up, or there was some sort of Halloween-y thing going on there. So we're keeping an eye on their calendar, and we anticipate that they will have holiday events in December. So once we spot one of those, we will schedule a demo in front of the aquarium. People are actually very interested in learning. I mean, you inevitably get a few people that are rude, but mostly people are just like, wow, I didn't know that. Or they're really curious to learn more. So, and the shark costume also just generates a lot of attraction. People are think it's really neat. So the ones we've had have been really well received, I'd say. So we'll we'll get one on the calendar. Keep an eye on the NARN calendar.
Yeah, that's good to hear that they're well received. I mean, like I said, being a vegan for a long time and having been exposed to some of this, sometimes I don't remember when it was, but when fur was kind of making a comeback, I'm like, really? I thought we were all done with that, but I guess the fashion industry at some point had something else to say. So
yeah,
it's good to keep that out there, but it's also I guess kind of stunning to me that they're doing that and bringing these animals from so far away.
Mm-hmm.
That seems kind of insane, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, they have not been forthcoming exactly how they're going to acquire all of these animals. There are a variety of ways that they can go and wild capture them from the Coral Triangle region, which they may or may not be doing. They haven't told us, and the fact that they haven't been forthcoming, is a little suspicious about how they're acquiring these marine animals. So they could wild capture them, they could purchase them from another aquarium, which is actually quite common practice, or they could breed them themselves. But we know that they have a holding facility, but we don't know exactly if they're breeding tropical animals for the shark tank.
We'd guess not, just based on the breeding part anyway, just based on our conversations with some other folks that we've been working with. There's a group in Hawaii that we've been chatting with that has a lot of knowledge about, especially tropical fish, and they don't do very well. So just based on conversations with some other folks, what it seems that they're doing is when the fish die at the aquarium, they just swap them out with ones they have in the holding facility. And then they basically have backup fish.
Yeah.
And it's sort of in a similar way with the, exactly, with the octopus, is they have a backup octopus. And I don't think people just don't know because they just haven't thought about it, which I totally understand. It's not like until it was brought to our attention, it hadn't been on our radar either. And so people just don't know that there's right now a giant Pacific octopus sitting in a warehouse in Soto just waiting for their turn. And it's people really like octopuses and they just don't know that this is what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm having a hard time with it. I mean, I think a lot of people do, when they go to the zoo, feel like the animals are depressed. I mean, even non-animal activist type of people, they can a lot of times tell that they don't seem happy that's great. You're spreading awareness. So sometimes people, I do think we're all so busy and distracted. Sometimes it's kind of hard to get out of your normal routine and wake up to things. Although you can only wake up to so many things at a time, or you might not be able to function. So, okay. And did you want to talk about the WDFW? Which I don't know what that stands for.
It's the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Hannah, that is very much up Hannah's alley, so I'm going to hand over to Hannah again.
We've both been working on this really hard, so I'm sure you'll have some input, Rachel. What we're trying to do with this is we are working on reforming the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And what we say when we mean reform is we're trying to implement conservation first policies in the department. Right now, the department is skewed more towards catering to what consumers would like in the state. And when I say consumers, I mean hunters and anglers, trappers, folks like that. We are trying to take it in a different direction. And it's not necessarily a direction that completely forgoes consumption of wildlife. Unfortunately, you know, being vegans, we would like to see that not happen, but that's not how wildlife management works in a state. And so what we're trying to do is just reform policy in the department in such a strategic way that the emphasis and the priority becomes conserving ecosystems instead of managing and conserving wildlife for the sake of consuming wildlife. Yeah. And so it's a really biodiversity first focused approach.
Yes, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, it specifies that hunting opportunities are, it's in their mandate. And so it's really not feasible to change their mandate. So that is why we don't have that on our, we're not even considering getting rid of hunting because that's just not feasible at all. Not to mention that anytime the hunting community gets even a whiff that any of their hunting opportunities might be threatened, they come out in large numbers and are very rude, honestly. And I understand that's not representative of all hunters, but there is quite a contingent of hunters that will come out to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has a commission that kind of sets a lot of the policies, and they have public meetings that we encourage people to attend and comment on, because there are some commissioners that are very interested in managing from an ecosystem standpoint, which of course is a much better way to manage, because if you try to single species manage anything, it's not going to work out very well, because that's just not how nature works. And, you know, a lot of the hunters just are kind of yell at them. So we are trying to be another voice and encourage a healthier way of managing the wildlife and wild lands in Washington state.
Yeah. And we have, you know, don't spread this around, but we have been able to insert some notions of animal rights in the department. You know, they're not going to look at it through that lens, but, you know, considerations of animals as an individual, you know, wildlife as an individual, that's starting to take hold in the department, considering the intrinsic value that wildlife has in and of themselves, you know, just a wild animal has, that's starting to take hold. And so our presence there is quite important because the department is on a cusp right now of change. And it's sliding ever so slightly into this more, you know, I'm not going to say animal rights lens because it's not, but it is really starting to look more
holistic.
Thank you. Yeah. Holistic than merely counting numbers of wildlife and saying whether they're sustainable enough to kill or not. And we were quite lucky to get into a space with other conservation groups who are not animal rights groups, but they work with us and we work with them. We're in a coalition and, you know, we're able to bring to the table some notions that are foreign even to these conservationists. And they, you know, are very accepting of it, are very open to it. It's been quite a pleasure to work with these other conservationists and to represent animal rights in a space that animal rights activists have not really been present in.
Yeah, I have learned a tremendous amount about how what the department does, you know, due to the COVID-19, putting everything online, a lot of these meetings are way more accessible. I was certainly never able to attend a Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission meeting prior to things going on Zoom. You know, I really can't take multiple days off to go sit in a room and listen to a commission meeting, but I can listen in on Zoom or, you know, listen to particular sessions as my work schedule allows. And so people can do that. And I think that's just, I was able to learn a lot, and I think more people can attend these meetings. And it is quite educational and quite interesting to learn about all the different regulations and all the different kinds of hunts that go on, or all the things that the department is working on. I mean, I had no idea that there was anything called a spring bear hunt until that was on the agenda a couple years ago, or the extensive ways that they have, or non-extensive even, about season setting, or they classify different animals. And so it's fascinating to me, as someone that just likes to learn things, but it's an individual can actually have a significant impact by commenting at these meetings. And so, you know, if anyone's interested in wildlife issues, we very much encourage people to listen to these meetings and give public comment, because it's pretty easy to sign up, and you don't have to show your face if you don't want to. You can just say what you want to say in your 3 minutes. And they are supposed to represent all of the folks in Washington state. So I do believe that the commission does take that quite seriously. I mean, the hunting community likes to say that they pay for everything with hunting licenses, but it's also within the department's mandate that they are supposed to be representing all the residents of Washington state. So.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I'm just blown away by how many projects you have and how complex they are, and how, like, especially you're saying with this one, you're helping. What popped in my head is, if you remember that poster where it's like humans are dominion over everything else versus mm-hmm. humans are just part of the ecosystem versus mm-hmm. being on top of it. So that's what it reminded me of when, you know, that you were kind of putting that idea out there that we're all part of it. We're not just in charge of everything.
Yeah. It's also been really nice to learn about other people in different parts of the state that are working on various issues. I mean, there's a community of folks in Klickitat that have been working very hard to make sure that the sheriff there doesn't massacre all of the cougars. And to learn more about their efforts has been quite interesting. And they have so much knowledge. And they're, you know, there's folks all over the state that are working pretty hard on various issues to protect wildlife that they're concerned about. And so that's also been really a wonderful part about being, a wonderful thing about being part of that coalition. Mm-hmm.
So many people working on things that behind the scenes that we don't even realize.
Yes.
That does help us to keep going when things do seem tough.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do want to mention that bears, cougars, and wolves are actually going to be, or have been, and will continue to be hot button issues at the department. And relevant to Oregon, the wolves in Washington, you know, some packs do go into Oregon and mm-hmm. vice versa. So, you know, it's worth taking a look at wildlife management laws, even in Oregon too, because it affects animal populations who do not respect state borders. Of course, they don't, you know, stop at the state line and not go over. So it really is relevant to a lot of people, cross state boundaries.
Let's talk about some of the other activities and events you have coming up.
Ongoing stuff, we have various committee meetings. We have an Animals and Labs committee. We have a vegan committee. We have a wildlife committee. And those are scheduled once a month. But I would also, once again, encourage people to look at our events calendar. And then I was also reminded, like, we have the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission meetings, and there's a schedule. So there's ones that come up. I believe there's one in December, and then of course there's ones in the next year, and you can always look at their calendar, but we have information on the NARN event calendar and our Facebook, our socials. Yeah. So all those things.
Yeah, go ahead and give the website.
Well, our website is just narn.org. So it's narn.org. And
Facebook, it was pretty easy to find. I think it
should be. And our Instagram handle, I forget what the handle is there, Hannah.
It's NARN Northwest, I believe. So NARNNW, I believe, or it could be NWNARN. I can't remember the order of it, but I believe it's NARN Northwest.
Okay, and for our listeners who are driving around and don't have a pen right now, I will put that on the KBOO website episode page. We'll have information about Northwest Animal Rights Network and their social media and website, so you can just go there and click on that. Any other events you wanted to mention? Not like that's not enough, but...
Those are the big ones. But yeah, I would say our events page and our Facebook are a great place to check for our events.
Okay. And then I also noticed on your website that you were looking for some interns.
Yeah. So we have a pretty great intern program, actually. We are looking for law and policy interns. We work with law students. Or we do have had a few upper class, like juniors and seniors, who are going into policy or pre-law. And we also are looking for a communications intern. And our intern program is one of my favorite things ever. I love working with students. How it generally works is, you know, they come to us to learn about policy and how to use the law to affect change in the advocacy setting. They don't necessarily, as I said, have to be law students, but students who are interested in policy, nonprofit work, or even pre-law, et cetera. And they typically, you know, work on a couple projects for us, but then my favorite thing is they get to take on a project where they lead. You know, they come up with the concept of it and they lead it and then they execute it. And it's always something that benefits one of our campaigns. For example, we had an intern over the summer who took a look at Washington State's Endangered Species Act laws and worked to reform them to make them better, actually. And so he did a whole overhaul of that. And now we're working to see what we can do in the legislature to strengthen our endangered species laws. And we can also go through the Department of Fish and Wildlife to strengthen some of those as well. So it really is relevant work that our interns are doing. They do solid, important work. They're just like another team member on our team. And I think they find a lot of value in it. I certainly find a lot of value in getting to work with them. So I really encourage... It's nationwide. It's entirely virtual, so anyone can apply, and I really encourage them to do so.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was going to ask, if it's like hybrid or virtual, because yeah, we have Lewis and Clark here.
So oh yeah,
would be interested. I'm sure you've had that. I mean, I just feel like the amount of information I've learned during this interview, like I can't even imagine, like the infinite kind of knowledge and experience that an intern could gain from working with NARN.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, well, I appreciate you both being here today and telling us about some of your works that you're doing. And I also see that you have an events page for some of the events we were talking about earlier. People can go to narn.org/events. And just overall, if you want to learn more about Northwest Animal Rights Network, you could go to narn.org. And I will post all of these websites on the KBOO episode page for that vegan show in case you're driving around in your car and can't write this down right now. Anything else you want to end with? I feel like you've given us so much information already, but just to check in.
This has been really great. I very much appreciate the opportunity to chat. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Hannah and Rachel. Like I said, I've learned a lot, and I think our listeners will get a lot out of this, and hopefully it'll inspire people who've been on the fence about getting involved to go ahead and do that. And yeah, I'd love to have you on the show again in the future, so you can just reach out if you have other initiatives you want to talk about.
Thank you so much. We'd love that opportunity.
Wonderful. So you've been listening to That Vegan Show, and we had a great interview with Hannah and Rachel from Northwest Animal Rights Network. Be sure to tune in every month on the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. to listen to That Vegan Show with your host, Melissa Lesniak. Have a good afternoon.
Benjamin, I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. World Ocean Forum is the World Ocean Observatory's online solutions platform, where we publish innovative ideas for necessary change in our ocean world. Recently, we published an article by McKinsey & Company, international consultants, that explored new strategies and products for the insurance industry in the changing climate era. We are already seeing the key role played by insurance as we face the destructive consequence of extreme weather, storm, flood, fire, heat, drought, erosion, inundation, and radical destruction of physical property and social dislocation. Government agencies like the Federal Emergency Management Agency, a division of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, are already signaling policy and coverage shifts as a result of limited budget, increasing numbers and amounts of claims, and the realization that existing policies and programs are not adequate to the new realities. Private insurance companies are limiting coverage amounts, and often, in the most vulnerable areas, canceling all coverage. This is compounded by the existence of reinsurance, where one company transfers some percentage of its exposure to another as a mitigation of risk and liability when disaster strikes. Risk assessment is a discipline, informed by real-world observations, statistics, projections, and predictions. Given the number and application of loss revealed in extreme weather events this year worldwide, you wonder if the assessments would argue for writing no insurance at all. The McKinsey report opened the discussion of a new insurance approach, adaptable to changing circumstance, that is more than reactive, but rather suggests an involvement by companies as catalysts and investors in new technologies and alternative opportunities based on future predictions, not historical actualities. The report proposes a diversion of premium revenue from conventional investment to climate investment in three areas: the net zero transition, new transfer offsets for increasing physical risks, and provision of adaptation and resilience services, offering a new blend of traditional property and casualty coverage, as well as innovative products to meet emerging market demand. The investment landscape is enormous as we move away from traditional fossil fuel technology to renewable alternative energy as a major counterforce and effective climate response. This new enterprise will need traditional insurance coverage for construction, surety, and liability. But there will be other opportunities for coverage of new adaptation and invention that will need protection against failure, income loss, unexpected events, and yes, even the continuing expansion of climate-related physical risk in any place at any time. Additionally, insurance companies can contribute through increased targeted investment, providing data, funds, and expertise to novel technology. Insurance companies can make and insure new capital investments through partnerships, guarantees, access to new investors and new markets, the efficiency of syndicated funds, and even the refocus of reinsurance, all tactics designed to reduce payouts and costs that are often a debilitating burden on startups or capital-intensive new ideas, while enabling alternatives and solutions. This reallocation, matched to the cessation of oil and gas emissions and their contribution to the ongoing climate change process, may be the ultimate risk reduction adaptation to be made here. And in that transition lies fresh profit generated as financial return, not loss. Social reorientation, health and safety, not destroyed communities and social unrest. And transition away from a failing financial model to a new insurance-supported economy that is proactive, not reactive, to changing conditions, in effect, a renewable resource in and of itself. We are faced today with inexorable change as a negative force and socio-political condition. We must now be aware of the damage any lack of response is incurring on our lives today, but more importantly, on our children's lives tomorrow. The insurance industry is a fundamental, powerful, and mostly invisible element of our livelihood. Knowingly and unknowingly, we live within its embrace. We cleave to it to ease the pain of loss of our health, our property, our community security, and our future. We may not be fully aware of its foundational presence in our lives until we face disaster and it is not there. It too must face the compelling consequence of climate change. We cannot dismiss or ignore it, as it might well be the force that drives the necessary change that our government and our own disabling fears have failed to embrace. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
Thank you. You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Gaza supera los 25.000 muertos por la guerra. Estados Unidos, Qatar y Egipto presionan por un proceso diplomático gradual para poner fin a la guerra en Gaza. Las familias de los rehenes de Hamas exigen que los legisladores israelíes hagan más para liberar a sus seres queridos. Ron DeSantis abandona la